baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and you fill in the blank. Summer and Chevy go together like road trips and sunshine. Check out the full line of Chevy SUVs and trucks at your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealers today. Chevy, drive Chicago.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. Thanks very much for that. Okay, we got a bit of an issue here. You're going to bed too early, or maybe you're staying up too late, but you're just not going out like you used to. That's the idea, the notion, the problem behind Imogen Willett's book, Up All Night. What does it signify? Well, Willett thought she might find out by looking at nightlife through the history of the world. And she joins us now to talk about it. Imogen, welcome.
Thank you very much, Steve. Hello.
Okay, so that was sort of an awkward introduction. How about this? You're known as a party historian.
Yes. Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that I'm interested in the way that people have had fun in the past. I think, you know, there are war historians interested in a very different kind of thing. I'm interested in the way that people had fun. And I think sometimes we can imagine that sort of hedonism is a bit of a 20th century invention. You know, Studio 54 happened and we've been going out and drinking and taking drugs since then. But I think it's fascinating to think about the ways in which people were going out and they were hedonistic 350 years ago, you know, in Shogun era Japan, in 18th century London. The nightlife that they had then, I think, would put our modern nightlife to shame.
And it's important for us, right? It's important for us to gather and have fun. I think it was Emile Durkheim you quote who says, talks about this collective effervescence. Explain that for me.
Exactly. I think it's a really wonderful description that captures what it feels like to experience that euphoric high of a crowd environment. So maybe it's at a World Cup match, maybe you're at a sweaty festival tent, maybe you're in a nightclub, maybe you're singing along at karaoke, but that kind of like prickly surge of euphoria, of feeling like you're part of something bigger than yourself, that has a name and it's called collective effervescence. And it's very fundamental to what it is to be human, I think. You know, that sensation, that feeling is very unique and it's very important. And nightlife is one of the ways we can access it.
I'm glad you referenced the World Cup because a lot of us here in the States who aren't necessarily football fans or soccer fans got to see a lot and learn a lot. And we learn a lot about that effervescence, right? That esprit with the fans from different countries. It was so much fun here, even for people who are just casual viewers. But we were witnessing what we might be losing in other parts of society.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think, you know, the statistics show us that people are turning away from nightlife in a way that I think is quite worrying. So in the UK, for example, there are bars and pubs and clubs are all closing at a really alarming rate. The same trend is happening more broadly across Europe and in America as well. And I think, you know, I think there are many, many reasons for what's happening with nightlife. But I would say that the kind of two main reasons that we're seeing this shift is, I think, the smartphones are meaning that people are kind of turning away from socializing in person and we're becoming a little bit more atomized. And, you know, particularly here in the UK and in Europe, you know, the economic situation is bad. And similar in America, in that just more and more of young people's income are going on rents because housing is so expensive. So it means that there's just less disposable income for people in their 20s and 30s to spend on these big nights out. And nights out themselves are becoming more expensive.
Imogen, go ahead, please.
But I think that there's a lot of research that's been done here with the Nighttime Industries Association here in London that's discovering that actually young people want to go out, but they just can't afford it. So I think the demand is there. People want to, you know, have these big nights out, but it's just the economic situation is tough.
I was talking about this on the radio yesterday, and one of the youngest guy in the crowd on the air said, well, yeah, drinks are $18 a piece, speaking exactly to what you just referenced. I want to go back to some of the statistics, though, because it's one thing to say the number of pubs and clubs are closing dramatically, but to actually put meat on that bone is pretty remarkable. 2013 to 2021, was it 2024? Half of the clubs in the UK shut down. Is that correct?
Yep, exactly. And if the current trend continues, there will be none left by 2030, which is, yeah, only 4 years away. So, yeah, nightclubs, are in a very, very tricky place right now.
Okay, we'll get back to where we are now and what we might do about it. But I want to go to where we started. And you mentioned feudal shogun Japanese culture. Who would have thought that the night out, the disco started in feudal Japan?
Yep, exactly. Yep. So autumn 1657, the beginning of modern nightlife in Edo, Japan, the city that is now known as Tokyo. And that's because the shogun gave this pleasure quarter called Yoshiwara permission to stay open all night, which was a privilege granted to no other place of public entertainment. So Yoshiwara was completely unique in that it was a nighttime place for people to party. And that really the reason that Yoshiwara was so central and so important to feudal era Japan is that Edo was a completely male dominated city. Men outnumbered women by 2-1. It was a kind of military authoritarian dictatorship of just samurai warriors and merchants getting very rich, just a boys club, you know, like a very sure. male testosterone fueled city. And really what he needed was a kind of pressure valve. So Yoshiwara was a place that was very female dominated. There were courtesans. It was a place of fashion, beauty, makeup, you know, a much more kind of feminine kind of space. And that's where men went to kind of let off steam and party and have a good time. And I think what's really interesting is that the shogun, it really worked. You know, there were no big revolutions, uprisings. It worked to keep the peace. And there were, yeah, that the shogun's political regime was safe because of it.
The warriors or whomever would go there one night a week? Would they go there one night a month, one night a year? Or how frequently did they go and how did they spend their time?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say the answer to that is it depends how rich you were. Mm-hmm. So a night out in Yoshiwara, incredibly expensive. So in today's money, you're talking like $10,000. Like it was like really, really like these are the people getting like, you know, VIP service in the most expensive Vegas or Miami club. Like that's kind of what we're talking about. And going to Yoshiwara was very much part of like conspicuous consumption. So of course, this is hundreds of years before we have cars. So instead of like revving a sports car engine and like getting people to look at you as you get to the club, the equivalent of that back in Edo was a white horse. So riding to Yoshiwara on a white horse was like you were proving that you were a kind of big shot and that you had the money for a perfect white horse.
So it was almost like a Disney World for adults, right?
Exactly. Yes. So it was, yeah, about 12 acres of space, and it was all given over to kind of, yeah, banquets, and very sort of high class brothels that in a very different way to the West, like you would have to have 2 evenings of partying with a courtesan before you could have sex with them. You know, it wasn't a kind of transactional thing that we might think of in the West. It was very different. There was a lot of art to kind of thinking about the seduction of it all. And the courtesans would emerge every evening in this procession with their amazing kind of hair all done up and makeup and kimonos and silk and just this, yeah, completely spectacular vision of female beauty that would happen every evening.
So there's a pleasure garden there. Maybe I want to jump to the pleasure gardens of the Victorian era, because yes. That's what they were called, right? Pleasure gardens?
Yeah, so Vauxhall Gardens, there are about 70 of them across London at their peak in sort of 18th century Georgian era. And I have to say, I mean, if I had the ability to go back in time, I would love to have a night in Vauxhall Gardens. They're just, there's not really a modern equivalent of them. These were just, yeah, extraordinary, late, open all night public gardens with all kinds of crazy stuff happening.
Well, walk us through one night. What would we do?
So I think one of the things which I find so fascinating that they were doing in Vauxhall Gardens is a big trend that lasted sort of 5 decades or so of volcanic eruption shows. So people became obsessed with volcanoes and this sense of apocalyptic annihilation. So Pompeii started to get excavated in about the 1740s, and then it basically created this trend for volcanomania, is what it was called. So what would happen at Vauxhall is every night, enormous pyrotechnics, like replicas of Vesuvius, sometimes even replicas of Pompeii, you know, villages, that kind of thing, and then firework displays, pyrotechnics happening, and you would just watch almost like a summer blockbuster film. You know, this is like going to Christopher Nolan, The Odyssey or something. You would just go and watch these enormous spectacles with 10,000 other people there, and it would just be, yeah, enormous show. And they just kind of were doing all kinds of crazy stuff. There would be hot air balloon takeoff. So ballooning was a kind of big thing that was happening at the time. The longest journey by air that had been conducted was from a balloon that set off from Vauxhall Garden. So it went all the way from London to Germany. And these three gentlemen were just sort of up in the balloon, managed to land safely and partied in Germany when they got there. And so setting off these hot air balloons was part of the Vauxhall entertainment as well.
Okay, so there were... So then they were drinking, right? They had access to alcohol and brothels, right? Access to prostitution.
Yes. So in Vauxhall, it was more, there was a place called the Dark Walk, which was unlit. So elsewhere in Vauxhall would have kind of twinkling lights and relatively well illuminated. And there was this one section that was quite dark. And that's where you would go if you wanted to find a prostitute or get up to no good. You know, that was the kind of hookup place.
So, but I guess my question is, the people who didn't have the money to go to Vauxhall or to in Japan, they were still drinking and visiting houses of prostitution, right? They just weren't doing it in a sort of collective celebratory way. Or what's the difference between the people who couldn't afford to go to Vauxhall and the people who could?
Yes, well, you raise a great question, because whilst Yoshiwara was very flashy, expensive, you know, for the kind of millionaires of their time, you know, these incredibly rich guys in Edo who were kind of showing off their wealth and that kind of thing, and very much conspicuous consumption and quite a kind of elitist place. Vauxhall was very, very different. So Vauxhall was actually pretty affordable for most Londoners. Entry was the equivalent of sort of $10, something like that. So really, like, most people in London could go and party in Vauxhall. And that was part of the magic of an experience of a night out in Vauxhall, because it was somewhere where different classes would come together in a way that was quite unique. And there's lots of kind of poetry and song lyrics of the time that talk about this sense of ambiguity, like someone's dressed up. Is that a lord or is that a, you know, merchant or someone kind of working class that's dressed up? We don't know. And that sense of, like, yeah, class ambiguity was really part of the fun of Vauxhall as well, part of the thrill.
I want to go, I mean, I could just jump from era to era with different, you know, we could talk all day about this, but I want to go to Montmartre and in Paris, and with the quote, I'm trying to find this quote from you. Oh, you said that nightlife thrives in opposition to mainstream culture. And I think the Moulin Rouge and what came before that maybe is a pretty good example of that. Sort that out for me, if you agree with that, and explain for me how that informs that quote.
Yes. So the sort of 1890s in Paris, really, really interesting time. So that's when you're starting to get these kind of hallmarks of 20th century modernity. So street lighting, electricity, cars you're starting to see on the road, not widespread, of course, but you're starting to see these kind of emblems of modernity that are about technology, progress, speed, all of this kind of thing. And that's that very much a sense of a kind of changing world. And what the most avant-garde, interesting, you know, eccentric artists, this kind of group of them who were all living in Paris at that time, they wanted nothing to do with the looming 20th century. They weren't embracing technology. They weren't embracing progress. What they were interested in was creating their own sort of reimagined medieval Gothic Hamlet. You know, they wanted darkness. They wanted gloom. They were obsessed with kind of ancient kings from like the 12th century and that kind of thing. And it was very much a statement against the technological changes that they were seeing around them. And so I think, yeah, it was very much in opposition to that sense of like where modernity was taking the culture, and they were trying to preserve something that was.
Well, when we think of the Moulin Rouge, we think of something bright and colorful and welcoming in the way that they were fighting. Correct? I mean, so how exactly. did it evolve?
So the Moulin Rouge opened a bit later on in the decade, and that was very much like catered towards tourists, because Paris by that time was like a nightlife destination for people from England would be going there, and France is kind of domestic tourists. But before it opened to coincide with one of the World Fairs. So these two very entrepreneurial guys were like, oh, great, this is a fantastic business opportunity. And it was very, brightly coloured, frilly, can-can, you know, all of this stuff. But what had been happening for the sort of 10 or so years prior to the Moulin Rouge opening was these much more like weird, strange, gothic cabarets that were exactly kind of harking back to a medieval past. And the Moulin Rouge was, you know, building on what had gone before and creating something that was very marketable to this new Parisian tourism scene.
You mentioned cabarets, and we think a lot about the years between the wars in Germany. And, of course, the film, the Joel Grey film, Cabaret, or Liza Minnelli. You write in the book that there sort of was a disconnect there, right? Our understanding or of what might have happened there with the parties and such didn't really meet up with the day-to-day life of Berlin.
Yeah, exactly, because I think we get swept up with this kind of cabaret myth, I think, which about, you know, thinking of what was going on in 1920s Berlin. And sometimes there's this sense that kind of, were people just partying so much and getting drunk and drinking and having all the sex that they just didn't quite notice this really horrifying political situation which was unraveling kind of in the background? And could they have done more to stop it? And, you know, I think that that's a little bit of the myth that we might absorb from things like cabaret. But what was really interesting researching that chapter in that time period is actually how much of that more kind of decadent scene was, again, very much being sold to the tourism market. Mm-hmm. So there were, you know, the most like crazy, decadent, like nudity and sex and drugs and all these kinds of things. That was very much like for American and British businessmen who wanted to go to Berlin and experience something crazy. Whereas the actual kind of much more authentic kind of queer night spots were very different. They would be kind of wearing like ball gowns and like riffing off kind of the sense of like high society and a bit more genteel. So there were these two sides to Berlin. And I think that what they were selling to tourists was the shock factor, whereas the authentic queer spots were doing something very different.
Here in the US, you know, this is embarrassing because I know that Americans don't know that they're... I love history. I think I know history pretty well. But I'm reading about New Orleans, and I'm like, damn, that's right. We did get Louisiana from Napoleon. I mean, I know all about the Louisiana Purchase and Thomas Jefferson and such, but it kind of... I didn't put Napoleon in the picture. So we buy New Orleans, we buy Louisiana. Of course, it's just a few decades after that, so it's still very French, when jazz starts to go through a bit of a revolution there, through a guy, I think is Buddy Bolden, right?
Buddy Bolden, really the inventor, the pioneer of jazz, whose name I think outside of jazz circles has been a little bit kind of lost to history. But what he was doing, and this is in the 1890s, is really completely like deconstructing the popular music of the time and creating something completely new in the process. So his performances would be about taking kind of classic, like, you know, American band, like marching music, and just shifting it and flipping it. And he claimed that he couldn't read music, so he was just like improvising the whole thing, which is a kind of contested thing. People think, you know, maybe he could have done, and like, it's maybe it's not that believable. But even so, there was a huge amount of showmanship to it that was just kind of really earthy, raunchy, completely different kind of music. And I think there are parallels, I think, with the sort of advent of techno, of just something that sounds completely unique. You've never heard it before. And I think what happened in New Orleans is that basically these kind of young working class, like black guys who heard this music and kind of got it and loved it. And the kind of older people who were hanging around New Orleans at that time were like, this is just not, like, they're playing it wrong. Like, I don't get it. But it really kind of picked up momentum, and more people started playing in what was called the hot style, which just meant, yeah, you're riffing and you're deconstructing and you're adding in your own notes. And it's just, yeah.
But if we're going to the Pleasure Gardens in London, in New Orleans, we're going to someone's house, right?
Exactly.
Everyone's having a party.
Exactly. So, and I think the New Orleans chapter is a really interesting one as well, because, you know, from what we were talking about before with the economic situation, young people having less disposable income, more money going on rents, on their rent, that people are going out less. And I think that New Orleans does show this really interesting counterexample to that, because it was a poor city, people were poor, and nightlife became a way of earning money, you know, when times were hard. So people would open up their homes for these things called Saturday night fish fries. And basically, think of it like a house party that charged entry. Uh-huh. So you would put a red light on that would show that, like, the house was open. You'd have a band performing, and you'd earn some money. And sometimes they were even called rent parties, because, you know, that the income that you would make from these things would go on to pay for your rent. So I think it's a great example that even in tough economic circumstances, you can still find a way, and nightlife can still thrive.
Okay, I want to go back to that. You said they would literally fly a red rag, right? Or a red light outside
the light.
House.
Exactly. And there was a lot of competition with who would get the best band. So that there was just, it just meant there was so much work for musicians in New Orleans.
Okay, bring that up, because I was in Peru a few months ago. Mm. And in Peru, they make their own sort of liquor. I think it's called chincha or something similar to that. And the guide was talking to us about it, and they said, you know, people make it themselves, and to make a little bit of money, you know, they will sell it out of their house. So they fly a red plastic cup on their porch.
There we go.
How about that? And so, you know, we'd go by these houses, and they'd be up, and some of us went to one of the houses. You'd see a plastic cup or a piece of red plastic outside the house, and go inside and buy the liquor that they had made. So,
wow, yeah,
it endures.
That's so, I love that. That's fantastic. Yes, I'm sure there is a kind of echo of these things. And I think that there's something so great about these, private spaces becoming public spaces, and people just, opening their homes up, having these wild parties, having jazz bands play, making some money from it as well.
And just sharing, creating some effervescence. Okay, one more. Because the anecdote about where we got the term nightclub, take me to Harlem.
Yes. So Harlem in the 1920s, absolutely the place to be if you want some wild, amazing nightlife, very much like, you know, all hours partying. We're in the Prohibition era. What that meant in New York is that the big kind of fancy night places,
sure,
they all started to close down, because basically they you just couldn't afford to run under Prohibition. All of these places earn their money through alcohol sales. Once that was illegal, it was like, you either break the law, try and survive before you get busted, or you're just going to go bankrupt. So it really completely changed what New York was like. You know, the places around Broadway, these like rooftop gardens that were kind of, very like flashy places, they all closed down. And so really then the emphasis shifted to Harlem. And the origin of why we use this now ubiquitous term nightclub was a tango dance waiter called Jules Asaldi wanted to evade curfew restrictions and found this incredible, ingenious loophole that was basically, if he registered his premises as a membership organization, it meant that he would be able to stay open all night, semi-legally. You know, we're talking about, it's a little bit dubious. Mm-hmm. He was opening a membership organization, not a dance hall. And it became known as a nightclub. And that's why we call it, that's why we still
love that. Another thing sort of related, I don't know if it's still the case, but it wasn't too long ago where Utah, a state in the U.S. that's pretty conservative and Mormon-driven, prohibited alcohol sales altogether unless you would go to a place and join the club. So it was a very real thing, you know, 20 years ago. It might still be today, where you'd go to a bar and you would literally join the bar's club, and then you could drink there legally.
Yeah, very, very similar.
So COVID comes, COVID goes, and when we were in the depths of COVID, I kept hearing these promises of the roaring 20s coming back. It was even, we were in the 20s, right? I mean, we were supposed to do that and have this wild celebration, and it didn't happen. Mm. Why didn't it happen?
I know. I think, yes, it is what we all were craving, what we all expected, what we all wanted. And whilst there was, you know, a little bit of that stuff happening in the early sort of 2020s, it didn't quite pick up momentum in this. We have not seen a repeat of, you know, the 1920s in the 2020s. And I do think that the use of smartphones, I think, have a lot to blame, really, in why we are partying less. You know, I think if you imagine like the hookup culture and the dating culture for young people, it used to be about going to a club and hooking up with someone and like then dating them afterwards or whatever would happen, or it was a one night stand or whatever. And now all of that stuff is being conducted through phones. So I think that kind of purpose or motivational reason to go out has completely changed. But I think that, you know, I do sort of end the book on a sort of hopeful, optimistic note, because nightclubs are closing. Nightclubs have only been around for sort of 60 years, 70 years. Centuries of nightlife has happened before then, and hopefully centuries of nightlife will happen after the nightclub. So I think if we imagine that nightclubs are closing, nightclubs might not be with us forever, but that doesn't mean that this is the end of nightlife. I think that what is much more likely to happen is that we'll see the next kind of innovations happen, like whether it's a new version of a rave scene, a new version of a pleasure garden. You know, I'm sure a lot of people would be quite up for some.
I'd like to check one out myself. Yeah.
Exactly. That I think nightlife has always been in flux. It's always changed with the times. And, you know, new forms of nightlife will eventually emerge because history tells us that's what happens.
And so we should look at our immigrant community or the outsiders of our community to see what they're doing, because that's where that comes from usually.
Exactly. Yeah. It is outsiders. The immigrant communities, you're absolutely right. They, you know, it was fascinating reading in my book about what happened in the 1920s and why it was such a kind of partying decade. And a lot of it was to do with the Russian refugees who were flooding into Paris and Shanghai from Russia after all of the upheavals with their revolutions in 1917. And so you would often have these like very aristocratic Russians who suddenly found themselves in Paris, and it was like, oh, I guess we'll open up a champagne bar. I don't know, with like the last bits of cash and jewels or whatever that they had with them. And so these kind of migration routes have very much been part of creating these amazing nightlife scenes. And traditionally, I think there is something about the outsider. There's definitely something about young people. You know, Buddy Bolden was a young guy. The people who were putting together like the rave scene in Detroit and things like that, all very, very young people. It's watching what that next generation are interested in and what they're doing.
Imogen Willits is the author's name. Up All Night is the name of the book. If you want to find out what we've been doing since the 1600s, maybe it'll help us inform what we're going to do. I enjoyed the book. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for taking time to join us.
No problem. I really enjoyed that, Steve. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you are. And I hope you'll listen every week. In fact, you can even subscribe at Apple Music or Spotify, or always check it out at WGNRadio.com, wherever you get your podcasts. Until then, we'll see you next week.